The morning dew glistens on blades of emerald grass. A gentle breeze carries the sweet scent of wildflowers as a herd of dairy cows grazes contently, their melodic lowing echoing over the rolling hills. Bessie, Daisy, Buttercup, and Clarabelle embody nature's bounty, their bodies nourished by the deep green grass of the pastures, their udders heavy with rich, wholesome, life-giving milk. This idyllic scene was far from the teeming streets of 19th century New York City, where a far different reality unfolded. Away from the countryside's pastoral charm, an insidious trade took root in the shadows of the city's outskirts. Here, in the swill milk stables, a horrific sight awaited. Rows upon rows of emaciated cows, their bones protruding from their mangy hides, stood in cramped, filthy stalls. Instead of lush pastures, these wretched creatures subsisted on a slop diet of distillery waste. It was in these squalid conditions that the city's milk was produced, a tainted, potentially lethal brew that would soon wreak havoc on the health of New York's most vulnerable residents. Welcome to As We Eat, where we explore the intersection of food, family, history, and culture.
We think there's something magical that happens when people get together and share food. Conversations seem to happen a little more naturally. We talk about our commonalities and our differences. We share stories, memories, and recipes.
And we'll use food to take a journey that explores our human experience. Share some fun facts and some that aren't so fun. Talk about food history and how food connects and defines us.
So if you've ever eaten, prepared, or shared food, then this podcast probably has something for you.
Wow. Hi, Leigh.
Hey, how are you doing?
Whoa, that is a lot to process. I am a lifelong milk drinker. And I have to tell you, this episode, while fascinating, has been a little bit of a challenge to stomach. This is a pretty big deal, what happened in New York. And I am so grateful, actually, that we've managed to work out some milk safety since then, because dang, I can't even imagine the scope and the scale of what happened.
Right.
I can't wait to hear you tell me more about it so I can get my facts straight.
I totally agree. This was probably, of all of the episodes so far that we've done on food and crime, this one was hard. I had to step away from the research a lot because, we're talking about animal cruelty. We're talking about death. We're talking about corruption. It's a lot. It's a lot to take in. But here we are.
Yeah. So it feels a little maybe disingenuous to be all chirpy and cheerful as we head into this topic. But I'm doing okay. And you're doing okay, I think.
Yep.
And we shall persevere.
We shall. Yes, we shall. Before we dive right into this diabolical scandal that I alluded to in the opening, I think it's best if we take a quick look at the liquid in question. Milk. It does the body good. Drink your milk. Got milk? These are some of the most current heralds of milk's indispensable position in our food pyramid. It's been touted as nature's perfect food, as the most complete food. This white nectar, wholesome, calcium-rich, and pure. Remember our conversations about food colors? White is purity. It's linked to childhood innocence with reference of milk and cookies. But in reality, fluid milk drinking is a fairly recent method of consuming milk. Most milk through the ages was preserved. Cheese, butter, and yogurt being the main products of this preservation process. Even here in the States, from the colonial times to the mid-19th century, the byproducts of these preservation methods, whey, buttermilk, clabbered milk, were actually fed to hogs rather than consumed. As a matter of fact, throughout history, fluid milk was considered a luxury because of its inability to keep. You could only have fluid milk if you could afford to have the farmer or shepherd deliver it to you. Now, America's relationship with fluid milk is a result of urbanization and industrialization. We have had so many conversations about the effects of the Industrial Revolution on our food sources and our eating habits, and here we go again. In the beginning of the consumption of fluid milk by non-aristocracy and royalty, it was embraced as a drink for infants and children. And to understand this, we need to do a little bit of history on breastfeeding and the profession of wet nurses. Yep, wet nurses were a valued profession in many countries and cultures. Now, employing a wet nurse originated out of necessity. A mother couldn't feed an infant because of illness, lactation issues, or she died in childbirth. But it turned into a choice of alternate feeding as early as 850 BC and through the 17th century. Wet nursing was a very well-organized profession. Contracts were drawn up, laws regulated the practice, treaties were written listing qualifications of a wet nurse, how to choose a wet nurse, the regimes of a wet nurse, tests to determine the quality of the wet nurse's milk, responsibilities of the wet nurse, which included singing lullabies to infants. I also love this list of qualities and duties of a wet nurse that was written by Bartholomaeus Anglicus, a Franciscan friar from the Middle Ages. A nurse rejoices with a boy when it rejoices and weeps with him when he weeps, just like a mother. She picks him up when he falls, gives the little one milk when he cries, kisses him as he lies, holds him tight and gathers him up when he sprawls, washes and cleanses the little one when he makes a mess of himself. Wet nursing went in and out of favor over the centuries as belief systems rose and fell, and generally they were dictated by social classes. It wasn't until the end of the 18th century through the 19th century that wet nursing shifted away from wealthy to the laboring class. Now, again, with the Industrial Revolution came this migration from rural areas to more urban areas. With the promise of consistent work came more financial obligations of city living, which required women to join the workforce to sustain their families, which in turn meant that after childbirth, these women weren't able to continue the breastfeeding tradition of rural life. And so wet nurses began to be employed by the lower classes, which I imagine added another financial strain, much like the daycare dilemma that we see women battle with today. Mm-hmm. There were, of course, alternate feeding methods that included clay feeding vessels, cow horns, bubby pots, pap boats, and sponges. Glass feeding bottles didn't actually come into the picture until 1851 in France. The nipples used were generally made from cork or leather. The Indian rubber nipple was refined over the course of the 19th century and became the most popular choice to use in artificial feeding, as it was called. With all this knowledge in hand or in brain, we're ready to begin our journey into what is called the swill milk scandal. Now, our illustrious Industrial Revolution has created cities. Cities that were not prepared to handle the huge influx of inhabitants. For New York City, this impact of Industrial Revolution is compounded by the opening of the Erie Canal, which thrusts this East Coast city into a position of an economic hub, a hub with no civil politics to regulate or manage this new economy. Now, at the beginning of the 19th century, the city's milk was provided by cows that were pastured in the city. But as the city spread, pastures made way for housing and industry, which meant that the milk industry had to pivot. And pivot it did, 360 degrees. Two of the industries that saw much success in New York were breweries and distilleries. Now, the byproduct of these industries is spent grain, which, if fed to cows after it has been strained, is a good supplemental feeding option. It's actually employed today as a sustainable and economic feed source. But with humans, power, and money comes corruption. And boy, did this get corrupt. Distilleries and breweries built dairies attached to their establishments to take advantage of the spent grain byproducts. I'm okay so far with this. Sounds like a win-win. Some of these distilleries and breweries would rent the attached dairies to dairy farmers, while others would start their own dairies. But rather than the pastoral bliss, these cows were confined to dark, dank cow sheds and fed a hot mash of spent grains and leftover liquids, which continued to ferment. So remember, the spent grain is good as a supplemental feed only if it's strained. But now we've got this swill, and in essence, what we're doing is we're creating these drunk, super sad cows. It was estimated that in 1845, 13,000 cows were kept and fed in this fashion. Not only were the cowsheds abhorrent, contributing to what the New York Times article called living a life of appalling misery, the milking process was so disgusting that I think I'll save the gory details and just say that no hands were washed, pails sat open, and illness in neither the cow nor the milker was of any consequence. What I will share, because it does convey the horrid living conditions of these creatures, is that it was reported that many of them were in such terrible health that hooves and tails actually fell off. It was also reported that up to and after death, these poor creatures were being milked. So let's talk about the milk. The milk that New York City's infants and children relied on for their health and welfare. First, we'll call it what it is. It's swill milk. It's a product of swill that was fed to them. Remember, these cows were being fed nasty mash that continued to ferment, which was passed on to the milk, and all of the nasties from the milking process went into the milk. Now, to counter the thin, bluish-colored liquid, many of the dairymen would add things like plaster of Paris to thicken it, yellow dyes to make it look more natural, and then they would market it as pure country milk. And this milk was so not milk that you couldn't even make butter or cheese from it. All of those good fats and nutritional components that made it nature's perfect food were stripped from this thin, disease-ridden drink. Now, it's hard to determine causes of death during this time when germ theory wasn't completely understood. But what we do know is that from 1870 to the 1900s, one out of every three deaths was a child under the age of five. And between 38 and 51% of infant deaths were from infectious diseases, and half of those were from diarrheal infections. Of course, we can't attribute all these deaths to swill milk, but what we do know is that infant mortality dropped in the first two decades of the 20th century. It was a direct response to the fact that the milk supply had been cleaned up. What's most appalling about this scandal is that it actually lasted 11 years before regulations and laws were passed. Part of this was the result of corrupt politicians, wealthy businessmen with much influence. Part of it was that the opponents of the swill milk industry were seen as using the dairies as propaganda for abolition, a very tenuous topic at the time, and partly because the general public didn't understand or have all of the facts, something that we talked about in our last episode with the reporting on the hot coffee case. An article in the New York Times from May 18th of 1858 alleged that the swill milk industry had fatally poisoned 8,000 infants in the city that year.
And if we're talking about the deaths of children from contaminated milk, it quickly becomes clear that something needs to be done. And there was an opinion piece from Frank Leslie's Illustrated newspaper, which ran a 5,000-word expose on May 8th, 1858, describing a group of Brooklyn and New York distilleries / dairies as milk murderers distributing liquid poison. To quote from that scathing opinion, "For the midnight assassin, we have the rope and the gallows. For the robber, the penitentiary. But for those who murder our children by the thousands, we have neither reprobation nor punishment. They are not penal villains, but licensed traders, and through their traffic is literally in human life. The government seems powerless or unwilling to interfere," end quote. Well, as you might imagine, there was massive public outrage after these articles were published. And in response, the powers that be sort of stirred into action. New York's political powerhouse, Tammany Hall, had Alderman Butcher Mike Tumani put in charge of the Board of Health investigation. And he, along with fellow Alderman E. Harrison Reed and William Tucker, ended up shielding the dairy distilleries, turning hearings into one-sided exercises designed to make critics and health authorities look ridiculous. And they even went as far as arguing that swill milk was actually as good or better for children than regular milk. Any visits or examinations paid at the dairy distilleries were done after they had received ample time to clean up. So touring the facilities just revealed happy cows in clean stalls with no showing of anything going wrong. The result of that was that the New York City Board of Health exonerated the dairy distilleries from doing anything wrong. But the people were not appeased at all. And some preliminary food safety laws were put into force in 1862, although Toume continued to work tirelessly to block any kind of food health reform, earning him a caricature as Swill Milk Toume. He ended up dying of a sudden heart attack in 1887, by the way. Now, despite the milk regulations that started in New York, true food safety for milk didn't come into the United States until the early 20th century. And in 1906, our heroic federal Pure Food and Drug Act laid down the law against adulterants, such as formaldehyde, that dairies were using to keep milk fresh. Heavy air quotes there. But none of these actions were enough to keep bacteria and pathogens out of raw milk. Basically, you got whatever the cow was feeling, that ended up in your milk. So if a cow had bacteria, it was in your milk. If a cow had typhoid, it was in your milk. Mm-hmm. Yum. Fun stuff. To give you a sense of how we actually ended up with safer milk, I have to take you back to the 1860s and scientist Louis Pasteur, everyone loves Louis, who developed a process that we know as pasteurization, actually for wine, when he discovered that heating a liquid to a temperature between 140 and 160 degrees Fahrenheit for about 15 to 30 seconds ended up killing harmful pathogens and bacteria without substantially affecting flavor. However, it was German scientist Franz von Sauklet, and I'm probably butchering that last name, Sauklet. I don't know how to pronounce these things in German. Franz von Sauklet, who would propose in the 1880s that pasteurization could be applied to milk. And in 1899, Harvard microbiologist Theobald Smith, this is the dude that discovered salmonella, incidentally, he discovered that milk pasteurization dramatically reduced pathogens and bacteria being carried in milk. It was Milton Joseph Rosenau, he was the second director of the U.S. Hygienic Laboratory, who actually established our first milk pasteurization standards. This is slow heating at 140 degrees Fahrenheit for 20 minutes while in service at the United States Marine Hospital. And this was also noted in his publication of The Milk Question in 1912. As a quick aside, I want to call attention to the difference between the temperatures for pasteurization being between 140-60 degrees Fahrenheit and the temperature of coffee sold at McDonald's franchise drive-thrus, which is about 180 to 190 degrees Fahrenheit. To know more about why this is important and valid, please turn into episode 82, Quiet Whispers, Hot Coffee, and Eggless Mayo for more information about the tort case of Stella Liebeck. The contrast between those temperature ranges actually boggles my mind. One is plenty enough to kill bacteria, and the other one is meant to keep your coffee hot on a long drive. It's just insane how different they are. But back to the milk. In 1924, the U.S. Public Health Service developed the Standard Milk Ordinance to create a basis for a uniform system of regulating milk across multiple jurisdictions. We're talking cities, counties, state, federal, right? It's broad. This ordinance was initially voluntary, so it wasn't actually a requirement. Although Alabama was the first state to adopt this ordinance in 1924, which really surprised me. But yay, shout out to Alabama. In 1947, Michigan State instituted the first statewide milk pasteurization requirement. So this is now a requirement as opposed to a voluntary thing. Since then, both the federal government and the United States, the literal United States, have worked together with the dairy industry to govern milk safety. But it wasn't until 1987, when I was in seventh grade, by the way, that the Food and Drug Administration issued its final regulation on mandatory pasteurization of all milk or milk products, with the exception of some cheeses, for sale or distribution in interstate commerce. That means that anything labeled as milk that is going to pass across state lines must be pasteurized. So we have this broad thing in place now where Food and Drug Act says you can't add anything to the milk to make it safe. Well, not even safe to drink. You can't add anything to milk. It has to be milk. And now you've got this pasteurization requirement by the United States. And the pasteurization thing was not without its controversy. At one point, before it really became a federal issue, we had doctors, pediatricians, actually arguing against pasteurization, saying that it removed all the good stuff that is inherent, all those good natural proteins and everything, that it was not good for children to drink, that it would lead to scurvy if they drank pasteurized milk. To this day, we have folks who are still on the raw milk bandwagon who say it's better for you. But I don't know, after reading about some of the horrors about what actually can be in raw milk, I love a raw milk cheese, but I'm actually feeling a whole lot of appreciation for the fact that we do have this recourse for keeping milk safe to drink. And is this the end all be all final word on milk safety? Actually, no. This is something that changes dramatically over time.
I think that, like you said, there are arguments that pasteurization, especially ultra-pasteurized, because that's what we see on a lot of the shelves now is the ultra-pasteurized, that it destroys everything that was good and clean within the milk. On the other hand, you have to remember corruption and what people are willing to do to make a buck. And if that means that they're going to sell you raw milk that they know is not good, then we have to be careful. We have to be careful about our choices. It's back to having that knowledge and that information so that we can make informed decisions.
Yeah. I think of all the setback that New York had with Alderman Toomey, who was being monitored. He was actually being watched by a group who was very upset that the reforms were not going through. And he was showing up to the houses of the people running the dairy distilleries late at night. He was obviously corrupt, and yet he had the voice. He had the ability to shield these dairies from what they were doing. And
yeah,
it's just horrible. And how you can do that to your fellow man, your two kids, is beyond me.
Children.
A man.
Right? When I was researching Mike Toomey, I came across this quote, and this is from Wikipedia, so bear that in mind. Mm-hmm. But it says, although short of stature, he was quite strong and became known locally as a bare-fisted fighter, which in turn brought him to the attention of local political authorities with ties to New York City's notorious machine, Tammany Hall. Not because he was a good human being, but because he could bare-fist fight. That really puts Tammany Hall into perspective.
Oh, yeah. If we were a different podcast, we could have a whole season on Tammany Hall.
Oh, yes, we could.
Maybe we need to spin off. And I know there's a lot of stuff out there about Tammany Hall, but man, that organization, man, they did a lot of stuff that was not so great.
Right. Yes.
But we tolerated, and it's weird to me why we tolerate that kind of corruption. Love to say that things are better now, but there was a huge milk scandal in China just in 2008.
Yeah.
We don't seem to learn sometimes.
Which is unfortunate.
Anyway, it is unfortunate. But yeah, I think of all the milk I've been drinking over the years up until now. Things were in place before 1987. Milk was safer to drink in my childhood, in our childhood. But
yeah,
it's considering pasteurization didn't really, Michigan, first statewide milk pasteurization requirement. In 1947.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's not that long ago, really, when you think about it. Thank you for spending some time with us today. We are excited to bring you some milk-curdling stories at the intersection of food and crime, and we appreciate you sticking around and listening to us talk. For more information about today's episode, check out our website at aswe.com. Please follow us on Instagram at aswe.eat and join our family recipes, traditions, and food lore community on Facebook.
And so you don't miss an episode, subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And if you could spare just a couple of minutes away from that glass of milk and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Podchaser, or Spotify, we would be ever so appreciative. It really does help with our goal of podcast domination.
We also publish the As We Eat Journal on Substack. We would be honored if you would support us by becoming a subscriber. We take tasty side trips through discoveries, table talks, food and art, vintage recipes, and so, so much more. We know you'll find something that appeals to you at asweeat.substack.com.
You've been listening to the As We Eat podcast, part of our curiosity-driven project, serving up how food connects, defines, and inspires by blending a bit of research with a dash of humor, a half a cup of ultra-pasteurized milk, and a whole lot of passion. Ba ba da ba 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 ba